Busy, busy, busy day. My goodness. You wouldn't know it was Wednesday. Usually by Wednesday, people are kind of slowing down. They view it as hump day. Not Jeff, my producer. No. Wednesday is the day when things get revved up. Here on Issues, Etc. I'm going to do that for you today. James Patrick Holding will join us here in the first 25 minutes of the program. You have seen this book. Perhaps you've even read the book. Perhaps you picked it up thinking, wow, that sounds great. The five people you meet in heaven. And, of course, Mitch's album was well-known for a previous bestseller, Tuesdays with Maury. And who would want to miss a bestseller nowadays? We're going to be talking about that book with James Patrick Holding here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I think I saw it on my dad's shelf when I was at home recently. Now, my dad's got a lot of stuff on his shelf. So if people went down into my office and looked what's on my shelf, they might think I was a heretic. And I have to explain, sometimes I've thought about putting up a sign, these books are here because I have to read them. It's part of my job. It's not because I agree with them. We'll find out what's going on in this book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven, here in just a moment. In the second 25 minutes of the program, the Magi, the wise men, they appeared in nativity scenes all over the world in the last couple of weeks. Most of them have disappeared. The real Magi, the real wise men, do not appear in the gospel until several years after the birth of the Savior. Why are they there? What brings them? We'll review the story with Dr. Paul Meyer of Western Michigan University in the second half hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. David Scare joins us again today, as he did yesterday, to talk about the commissioning of the 12 apostles, this second of the discourses, Jesus, a block of teaching there, the red letter that where you stop with the black ink and you start with the long sections of red ink in your red letter edition Bibles in the Gospel of Matthew, the second of those, the commissioning of the 12 apostles. We're going to talk about authority in the church today. He's author of our Issues, Etc., book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, and I'll tell you more about that a little bit later. Then, moving on in the second hour of the program, Dr. Larry Rast joins us. We'll be talking to him about doctrine and evangelism, whether or not the two are mutually exclusive, or whether there's even a tension between pure doctrine and zealous evangelism. And we're not done. That's just the second hour. In the third hour of the program, Congressman John Shimkus will join us. We'll talk about what's going on in Washington with the opening of a new congressional session, the president in Collinsville, which is of special interest to Congressman John Shimkus, given the fact that that's part of his congressional district. And then in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc., Peter LaBarbera joins us. You may have seen the story about this new poll conducted in Illinois by an Illinois gay rights group having to do with a bill that is facing the Senate in Illinois probably early next week, having to do with discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Peter LaBarbera of Illinois Family Institute will be joining us there in the last part of Issues, Etc. You join us as well. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Wednesday. It's the 5th of January. James Patrick Holding is our guest, president of Tecton Apologetics Ministries. He's author of the book, The Mormon Defenders. And JP has also written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Politically Correct Afterlife. He joins us to talk about this book by Mitch Albom, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. JP, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd. Thanks for having me.
The title alone sounds so innocuous. Most people would probably pick it up and say, this looks like it might at the very least be interesting and maybe even be kind of quasi-Christian. How would you assess the book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven?
Well, as a literary work, I think Mitch Albom has done an excellent job. I'm not going to take away anything from him as a storyteller. He is certainly a very good storyteller. The problem we have, though, is that as Christians, books like this may give people ideas about salvation theology and incorrect ideas about salvation theology. You know, this is similar to the problem we faced with the Da Vinci Code, which we've talked about before. People will pick up something like this, and if it seems like a good idea to them, they may think some of the ideas are worth absorbing into their own belief system. And so there is a need for us to critically examine this book and question some of its principles.
What is the book about? Is there a story here that's at work?
Yes. This is a somewhat biographical story about an 83-year-old amusement park worker whose name is Eddie, and no last name is given for him. He's simply known as Eddie throughout the book. The story begins with Eddie being killed in a accident at his amusement park when he is trying to save a little girl from being crushed by a malfunctioning park ride. And the book switches thereafter from various scenes of Eddie in the afterlife and one of his friends rearranging his affairs on Earth after his death. And it's in some of these scenes of the afterlife that we get some pictures of Eddie as he lived on Earth and as he lived with these five people that he meets and what effect they had on him.
So what is the, if you could boil down the premise of this story of Eddie, his death, the afterlife, what's the premise of Mitch Albom's book?
I believe the premise could be summed up as saying that in two ways. First of all, everyone is interconnected and everything has a purpose. And second, you are receive salvation, so to speak, by coming to understand your place in the world.
Okay, now the first of those two premises, or the first part of it, is genuinely innocuous. There, I can't find anything to object to in that.
Not at all, in principle, from the way it sounds. And you know, Christianity, of course, maintains the very same thing. The key is, where does that purpose find its root? And you know, many religious beliefs do give you that kind of satisfaction. But, of course, if the object of the belief is not in the true God, then it's just as well nothing at all.
The second part of the premise, where's the problem there?
Well, the problem is that this really says very little about true salvation. One of the key problems I noted is that Albom does not say anything about what role sin plays or what role forgiveness plays or even what role God plays in the whole panoply of options. Indeed, God only makes an appearance at the very end of the book and says maybe one word, home, and that comes out of a somewhat pantheistic chorus of human voices. There's no indication that God is any kind of person with whom we need or must have a relationship or who has anything to do with us at all. Indeed, Eddie prays in the book a couple of times, but he stops praying when his situation is hopeless. And another statement made by one of the characters goes like this: you have peace when you make it with yourself. Nothing is said about making peace with God or getting to know God.
Is this in any sense, because I've seen this on the shelves of Christians and Christians who say, look, it's got heaven in the title. It must be something right up my alley. Is this in any sense a Christian book?
I see no reason to think so. I mean, the Bible is mentioned once as an accessory during a funeral. There's a brief allusion to Adam in one of the stories, but there is certainly nothing explicitly Christian about it, and much of what is said is contrary to Christian beliefs about salvation and the afterlife.
What is the picture of the afterlife painted in this book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven?
Albom only goes to a certain extent with that, with Eddie. He has the characters explain that when a person dies, their first experience in the afterlife is to meet five different people who most influenced their own life, and this is accomplished by meeting them within their own heaven. Now, after you get through with your five people, you go to your own heaven, and each person's heaven is constructed around what was the greatest or most ideal portion of their life or what they enjoyed most. To give a specific example, the first person that Eddie meets was a circus performer who affected his life when he was a child. And this circus performer had the happiest years of his life during a specific period when he worked for the circus. So his own heaven is a snapshot of those particular years, you might say his salad days, during which he had the greatest success and was the most happy. And another person that Eddie meets, their heaven is a roadside diner. So there, it's really completely subjective as to what your heaven is like.
That's kind of interesting that you bring that aspect of the book out, because you mentioned before that the premise was we're all interconnected, a very strong emphasis on community and the interconnection of people's actions and deeds and lives. And yet when it comes down to it, the afterlife is radically individualistic.
That is an interesting irony that you have there, that you pointed out. Now, Albom does seem to indicate, however, that people in these heavens can affect the people who are on Earth, even as they talk to them up in the afterlife. But so he does maintain an interconnectedness in a way, but it's an individualist collectivism, you might say. Very ironic and contradictory within itself.
So what is it? A couple things here. First of all, I'm thinking about the Christian who picked up the book, who read it. Maybe they didn't read that carefully. Maybe they were simply engrossed in what you have already said here is a fair amount of storytelling.
Right.
And fairly well told. And they come away from it saying, you know, that didn't seem so bad. What would you point out to such a person after they've read the book and have not caught some of the things that you noticed in this book?
No, I think I would first of all ask them what they think the process of salvation is. And if they come through with that, with a correct answer, biblically based answer, I would say, and how do you think this particularly relates to what Alvin presented? Do you see that as corresponding to it or conflicting with it? And then from there we can figure out, you know, what their issue is with the book, whether they truly understood what the message is about. Now, in fairness, you see, Alvin doesn't present any coherent theology of salvation. I don't think he was trying to. But he raises enough questions to where we'd have to take in mind what he's saying and deal with the people who take their own understanding from it and maybe try and synthesize it with their current beliefs. And that's very important because there's simply no way we can synthesize Alvin's salvation theology with our own or the Bible's.
The other person who might pick it up says, look, I like it because, and I do know what it says, and I've noticed those things, and that's what I like about it. I like the fact that it presents a picture of the afterlife, sans sin, judgment, the wrath of God.
Okay. Well, it's we do believe, of course, that after, you know, there will be no actual sin in the afterlife, but we do believe in judgment. But liking it is not the same as making it true. I mean, this is something we may desire that heaven will be a place of ice cream parlors and that we'll get to eat Rocky Road for all eternity. But that's not going to make it any different, any more than wishing that when you go outside you'll have a Ferrari, you'll have that brand new car in your driveway. It hasn't worked for me yet.
James Patrick Holding is our guest. We're talking about the best-selling book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven, by Mitch Albom. James is president of Tecton Apologetics Ministries. He's author of the book, The Mormon Defenders, and he's also written an article for the latest Christian research journal titled Politically Correct Afterlife. Have you read The Five People You Meet in Heaven? Give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You also mentioned the problem of evil and the somewhat disturbing manner in which Albom deals with that classical philosophical and theological problem. First of all, what's the problem of evil, and how does Albom deal with it in his book?
Well, the problem of evil is the classic question, you know, if God is so good, why is there evil in the first place? And then second, what is God going to do about evil? And Albom in particular has a story that I found somewhat disturbing, in which a friend of his father's nearly rapes Eddie's mother. Now, the rape is not consummated, which left me the question, well, what would have happened if it had been? But what we are told by Eddie's third person is that Mickey had this excuse for nearly raping Eddie's mother because he had just lost his job that afternoon. He was under stress. He was, quote, coarse but not evil. He was, quote, committing an act of loneliness and desperation, acted on impulse. And this left me wondering, well, what is this same reasoning going to be able to be used for any act of evil? And again, what if he had actually completed the act? Then would Alvin have come to a victim of a rape and say, well, that person who did this to you was committing an act of loneliness and desperation? I see, I've worked in the criminal justice system, and I know many criminals who would be happy to take that line of reasoning to get them out of prison.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jason is calling from Durham, North Carolina. He listens on the Internet. Jason, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Pastor. My wife is currently reading this book, and she describes it as a fable. Now, I don't know if the guest would consider this book to be a fable or not, but if he does, what would be the moral of this story? Thanks a lot.
That's an excellent question, Jason. Well, certainly it isn't. It's intended to be fiction. Let's talk about it as a fable, and if so, what is the moral?
Okay. I do like the idea of putting it in the genre of fable. I would consider it a morality play, so to speak, much in the line of Aesop's fables. And if there is any message to be taken all from it, it has to do with the interconnectedness of all people that Alvin wishes to get across. I believe he wishes to establish the idea of community not only here on earth, but across the ages, so to speak, and even into the afterlife. And that, of course, can be a very comforting message for people. I think it's summed up best on a phrase in page 48, all lives intersect. And that's a very meaningful message for people in our society today, where there are many lonely and scared people who are alone right now.
Is there any caveat to that? Because certainly with all of the concerns that you've raised here, that simply can't be. If someone says, okay, that's all I'm going to take away from it, all lives are interconnected, boom, and I think it was a great book.
The caveat to that is how it's specifically worked out by Albom, because the way he gets the message across is with his specific method of salvation, and the appearance of the people in the five heavens. There must be some way to evaluate this truth claim, and if he wants to work out that message, there's no way to make the content validated unless you have a process whereby it is validated. So this leads to the question, is what he offers as a salvation theology even true, or is any part of it true? And that's the caveat where we have to be cautious.
There is a heaven. There's lots of talk about the afterlife in terms of heaven. Does Album present any picture of the converse of the afterlife, hell?
None whatsoever. In fact, I found no indication that any person ever went to hell.
So, in addition, you've talked a lot about the kind of scheme of salvation that Album seems to be operating with. It sounds as though it's also a universalism.
It does sound like that. He never specifies that any person is not saved or does not go to any particular heaven. And again, I have to be fair, he may not have intended to do that. And if it is intended as a fable, then it may have been asking too much of him. But still, the answer needs to be given to us if we're going to take what he says seriously, or if people are going to take what he says seriously.
Well, here's my concern. I agree with you that this is the kind of thing that ought to be taken as a fable, but fables ought to have the message of a fable. If it has a moral or a message, we ought to hold it to the same standard of truth.
Absolutely.
We ought to expect fables, whatever they may be, like Aesop's fables, to teach true things rather than false things. And I guess what I'm concerned about is that there is enough mythology and fabulizing about the afterlife, even among Christians nowadays.
Yes.
This would seem to make the waters quite a bit muddier.
Yes, well, that's very true. I mean, the lack of discernment is a key problem. If you tell the Aesop's fable of the fox and the grapes, no one's actually worrying about talking foxes that carry grapes around. But with something like this today, we have something that is a very realistic setting, a fable that is put in a very realistic way. And we also have the problem of the uncritical nature of people picking this thing up and adding it to their own lifestyle.
So according to Album's book, if we are to take him seriously in what he's saying about the afterlife and about human beings, how would you tease apart the question of what is Album's view of man? What is man's basic problem?
The implication I get is man's basic problem is that he is alone and needs other people. And that's what I could draw from it, that we need meaning and purpose, and that's the only way we're going to get fulfillment. Now, God is in the picture, but only as one who's maybe in charge of seeing that we get fulfilled, shall we say, of putting us in the right place and giving us our direction.
You mentioned before that fulfillment or paradise really amounts in this book to someone being at peace or coming to terms with themselves.
Yes.
What does Album mean by this?
Well, in one part of the book, he has the person who says, you have peace when you make it with yourself. And in the case of Eddie, this added up to understanding why people acted in his life as they did. For example, he had a very cruel father. And part of this was coming to understand why his father was so cruel and so mean to him, because all his life he had resented his father for being that way. And one of the things that is explored is, this is what happened to your father, and this is why he did this to you. In other words, exploring the purpose behind things that had always mystified you in life, why there was always a problem. But his second person, for example, was a drill sergeant that he was in the military with, and he had often not understood why the drill sergeant did a particular act to him, and the sergeant explains why he did it at that time. And so I think it works out to, all your questions are answered, all the mysteries are solved, and now there's nothing further to worry about.
So salvation becomes enlightenment, or in the end, really just simple knowledge.
Yes, more or less. I think that it's encapsulated as well with the fifth person he meets, who was a child that he accidentally burned in wartime when he set their house afire. And in order to atone for his error in burning the child has Eddie wash the wounds off, and that is considered essentially atonement. And then the child says, I wanted to make sure that you were helping children as a way of atoning for what you did. And so it specifies that this child had something to do with Eddie being an amusement park worker, in other words, in a situation where he would help children.
So it's in addition to just enlightenment, it is self-atonement.
Yes, you could say that, very much so.
What kind of God is pictured there, and does Jesus play in any shape, matter, or form a part in the afterlife of Mitch Album?
Jesus is mentioned nowhere, and there's no indication of any kind of role equivalent to what Jesus plays, that is, a broker between God and man. I've mentioned already that God comes in at the very end of the novel as speaking one word, home, and that comes out of a somewhat pantheistic chorus of human voices. Elsewhere in the book, Eddie is told that God is someone he can always talk to and that God knows where he is, but there's nothing to indicate that he has to establish any kind of relationship with God. I guess you could qualify it somewhere between deism and pantheism.
Is this book reflective of kind of the, fluid state of pop spirituality in our culture today?
There's no question. I would assuredly say that it is.
And finally, before we go, it is interesting that books like this sell so well. And how would you account for that?
I believe that people are hungry for the kind of message that that the book gives. These people want some idea of what their purpose is. They want some assurance. They want some idea of community with others. They're lonely, and they want something to know that their life has purpose. And a book like this reassures people of that by giving them some idea of how purpose might be fulfilled, or that they might have some role to play, or that they truly are involved with others. And that, I think, may lie behind the success of it. I mean, the title itself will attract people. It's by people you meet in heaven, any kind of afterlife thing. I mean, we've seen that with all the success of shows about angels on television. So that by itself will attract them, and then I think word of mouth and recommendations will make it more desirable for people.
Tectonics.org is the website for Tecton Apologetics. It is spelled TECTONICS.ORG, TECTONICS.ORG. And James Patrick Holding is president of Tecton Apologetics Ministries. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you again for having me.
James Patrick Holding is also author of the book, The Mormon Defenders, and he's also written an article for the latest Christian Research Journal titled Politically Correct Afterlife, a review of the best-selling book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven by Mitch Albom. When we come back from this break, the next 25 minutes of the program we will spend with Dr. Paul Meyer of Western Michigan University. We are in the season of Epiphany. In fact, the 6th, that is tomorrow, is Epiphany Day itself, in the beginning of a rather long season in the church year. One of the characters that always comes from the stock characters of the New Testament during the season of Epiphany, although it's not really what the season is about, are the Magi, the three wise men, or, you know, we don't know how many there actually were, but legend says three. Who were they? What were they up to? Why did they and when did they come to see the baby Jesus? What is that story in the New Testament all about? We'll find that out when we come back from this break with Dr. Paul Meyer. Then in the second hour of the program, we have two guests. Dr. David Scare will talk about the second great discourse of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. And there in the second hour, we'll also be talking to Dr. Larry Rast about doctrine and evangelism. Where do these two things, pure doctrine and zeal for the lost, are in any way mutually exclusive, or if there's even a tension between the two? Our call-in numbers for the next 2 hours, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then in the third hour, Congressman John Shimkus will join us. We'll get a Washington update, and we'll be talking with Peter LaBarbera about that new poll conducted by an Illinois gay rights group having to do with what Illinoisans think about discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Well, the gay rights group in their poll says that Illinoisans don't want any kind of discrimination. We'll find out whether the poll is good in the third hour.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Why did Jesus spend so much time teaching his disciples? And when he taught them, what did he teach them? How do teachings like the Sermon on the Mount fit into the broader scope of Jesus' whole teaching and life and death and resurrection? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is called Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. David Scare. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for information under the What's New section on our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, or order Discourses in Matthew for $29.99 plus shipping and handling from Concordia Publishing House. Call them any weekday during regular business hours. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org.
Here's your chance to learn something new about Buddha so you can better pray for them. This Global Minute lets you hear what Buddhists think about prayer. Prayer flags are popular in one part of the Buddhist world. According to ancient Tibetan Himalayan tradition, as wind drives the flags, prayers are unleashed to the heavens. As the square flag's edges start to fray and the vivid colors begin to fade, all the prayers are said to be released. They say five different colors represent the five elements, or the five different postures of Buddha. Blue stands for space, while white symbolizes water. Red is for fire, green equals air, and earth is represented with yellow. Buddhist prayer is a form of personal meditation. Pray many Buddhist hearts will be converted and that they might pray to the one true God who answers. Learn more about Buddhist beliefs and ways you can pray with a visit to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. There is a notion, I often encounter it in ministers and seminarians, that full-time church work is a nobler spiritual calling than other professions necessary to daily life together. You start to wonder, though, when you remember whom Christ called as his disciples. Fishermen, stay-at-home women, tent makers, tax people, and so on. Yesterday, the men and women elected to the 109th Congress gathered to begin their work of governing. Martin Luther wrote, "Government work needs abler persons than the office of the ministry. Therefore, it is necessary to keep the best boys, and today we would add girls, men and women, for this work. For in the ministry, Christ does everything through his Spirit, but in the kingdom of the world, one must use reason. Governing is, therefore, the more difficult task." So we pray God's guidance and care, not only upon church workers, who do have a noble calling, but also upon all the men and women who are serving God's purposes through their work in government. John Newton, author of Amazing Grace, wrote to a member of the British Parliament, William Wilberforce, "It's hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of the nation." Agreed.
Brr, it may be winter, but baseball fans can still be busy. You can spend the afternoon reminiscing with Jack Clark, former first baseman for the St. Louis Cardinals, at the Missouri History Museum on Sunday, January 9th, as part of the Missouri Historical Society's Second Sunday Celebration Series. The event is free. Some fans will have an opportunity to have their picture taken with a former Cardinal slugger. Bring your baseball memorabilia for Clark to autograph. Clark will be at the Missouri History Museum from 2 o'clock till 3:30 p.m. on Sunday, January 9th.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Paul Meyer joins us here in the next 25 minutes of the program. Tomorrow, it actually is, the 6th, is Epiphany Day. Now, Epiphany is not about the wise men. It is about the manifestation, not of a star or wise men or magi or three kings, but of the one to whom they visited, and that was the Christ child himself. But why is the story of the three wise men in Matthew's gospel? Do they belong in those nativity sets? I mean, we had them in our nativity set. Now, we put them outside, kind of on their way in. But as the crow flies, they're 10 feet away from the stable on Christmas Day. Is that how the story reads? We'll be answering that question up front with Dr. Paul Meyer here on Issues, Etc. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment on the Magi, the wise men, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's author of several books, including his latest, a novel titled More Than a Skeleton. And he will be speaking this Saturday, January the 8th. That's this coming Saturday at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church on the subject of St. Paul and the spread of Christianity. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Todd, it's good to be with you again.
And it's good to hear from you. We set up our nativity set in the house. Now, my son has a very curious way of setting it up. He puts Jesus at the back of the stable, and everyone crowded in with their backs to us, probably more like the real Christmas, more Christmas Day looked. But he got the wise men in there, too. They belonged in the set. Do they belong in there, on Christmas Day or not?
Nearly all creches under the Christmas tree will have the Magi kneeling at the manger along with the shepherds, kind of conflating the two accounts from Matthew and Luke, respectively. But that would be impossible because Matthew clearly tells us that by this time the Holy Family is living not in a stable or a cavern, but in a house. And it's quite clear that the Magi probably came minimum 40, 41 days after Christmas. The reason I say that, Todd, is because, don't forget, after the Magi visit, there's an all-points bulletin out for this baby. And clearly, Joseph and Mary present Jesus at the temple on day 40, when he's 40 days old, and there's no way they would have gone to Jerusalem if Herod is out to kill all babies 2 years old and under, especially some coming from Bethlehem. So we assume, therefore, the Magi came 41 days after Christmas plus sometime. Not 2 years. I think very often we have a mistake and think that the Holy Family was living in Nazareth, for, I should say, away from their home in Nazareth, down in Bethlehem for 2 years, but I sincerely doubt that because it's expensive to live away from home. And so I really think it was probably rather soon after the nativity itself that the flight to Egypt took place.
That term that we use, Magi, I know that it is simply a transliteration of what Matthew's Greek text has there, but what does it mean?
Well, I'm glad Matthew uses the Greek. The Magoi, plural in Greek, stands for a caste of very wise men. Indeed, they were the walking universities among the Greeks and the among the Persians, I should say, and the Babylonians. In the absence of universities, they had this caste of scholars, religious connotations as well, who were supposed to be informed in terms of the various religious traditions of the day, as well as there were astronomers, astrologers, and people like that.
Okay, so we're dealing here with learned men who at least on one occasion had an interest in what's going on in the stars, in the celestial realm, because they noticed the star. Tell us what this star is all about.
Well, we wish we knew. If we had an absolute fix on what the Star of Bethlehem was, we'd have an absolute date for Christmas very easily. But we don't have such an absolute fix because we don't know exactly what the star was. There are two general interpretations. One is that it was an astral event of natural variety, which God could have used, and the other is that it was a miraculous astral sign which is beyond any natural explanation. I think Christians ought to be broad-minded enough to accept either interpretation. If you want a natural phenomenon, I think nobody had a better idea than our Lutheran astronomer Johannes Kepler over in Europe in the early 1600s. He saw a very rare phenomenon, the triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, so rare that it happens only once every 8 centuries. It happened at the time of the first Christmas. It happened in 800, happened in 1600 when Kepler saw it. Will not come again till 2400 A.D., so please do not try to wait around for that one. But it would be just spectacular, though. It would be two of the brightest guy almost hitting one another at the same time. It would be just tremendous.
Now, the thing that intrigues me about the way that Matthew tells this, the Magi come from the east, they come into Jerusalem, they begin inquiring, where is he who was born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east. What does this mean, his star?
Well, of course, you have to remember the Babylonians and Persians, among their stargazings, were not just scientific astronomers, but astrologers as well, which is the camp followers of this particular science, you might say. And every sign of the zodiac, they invented, in fact, the 12 signs of the zodiac for us, and they invented this idea that the various configurations of the planets and the signs of the zodiac at the moment of your birth will foretell your fortune. And so they assumed then that this prince, you know, had been born under a given sign of the zodiac, and they wanted to seek him out. Again, to be sure, they were astrology was hopelessly incorrect. In fact, I hope your hearers aren't interested in astrology either. But the Magi were, and you know, never underestimate God's ability to use whatever means He wants in order to get His message across.
So they seem to know enough, either on the basis of their mistaken understanding of astrological signs, or perhaps a passing knowledge of maybe even Old Testament prophecy, that this is a significant event, that they ought to come and witness the birth of this prince. They don't know where he is to be born, though. They're not familiar enough with Scripture there, although the scribes and the teachers of the law seem to come up with the answer pretty quickly.
Well, the book of Micah, of course, you know, refers to Bethlehem. It's interesting that Herod's priests and advisors were able to pinpoint that one right away. I think, you know, so often this particular aspect of the nativity is doubted, Todd. You know, how could supposedly wise men traipse across a desert following a star and then come into Jerusalem loaded with that almost too perfect question, where is the newborn king of the Jews? We've seen a star in the east. And the objection is that they would never have known about the star as a messianic symbol, and therefore this is just Matthew's invention. But I oppose that viewpoint simply because everybody overlooks Nebuchadnezzar and his conquest of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. and his transplanting into Babylon the priestly caste, the professional people in Jerusalem, not the common laborers, they could stay, but this whole group were all the superior intellects that were transferred to Babylon, and not all of them returned under Ezra by any means. They stayed on in Babylon for the next 1,000 years. Where do you suppose the Babylonian Talmud was edited in 400 A.D., 400 years after that Christmas, you see? So you're going to have a big Jewish colony there that would be able to bring Old Testament information and prophecies and the significance of the star, make that readily available to other religious scholars across the street. So I think we got to watch out for our premises that are we use those in terms of trying to deny what happened.
They say we have come to worship him, and then Herod, of course, in a duplicitous act, says I want to worship him too. Matthew will even tell us there near the end of the account that when they saw the young child, Mary his mother, they fell down and worshipped him. Is this mere giving honor to the birth of a foreign dignitary? Is this worship in the sense that we genuinely think of worship?
Well, you know, if Matthew would have had the leisure available and maybe, a lot of scrolls and scribes, he might have given us a whole gospel on how the Magi found out about this and what their genuflection, what their worship really meant at that point. We don't have that information. Matthew's got a more important story to tell us, obviously. And so we just don't know what else is going on there. But I feel firmly the Magi would have been able to get all the information they wanted about the star as a messianic symbol. They would have been acquainted with the Balaam story, the star rising out of Jacob, you recall, and how this was the messianic sign. By the way, very often, you know, you hear the criticism that Matthew invented this star as a messianic symbol. But hold it. 130 years after that first Christmas, we have the final attempt of revolution by the Jews under Bar Kokhba. And his real name was Simeon Bar Kosiba. But in 132, the great Rabbi Akiba put him on a white horse, led him through the streets of Jerusalem, and said, "Bow down, the Messiah has come, the Messiah has come." And that was proven by the way they changed his name. It wasn't Bar Kosiba anymore. It was Bar Kokhba, which means son of the star. Okay? So you see, the star symbol was very, very common, and it was very much understood as a messianic symbol.
Tell us about Herod. Herod gets a lot of play there in Matthew's nativity account. Who is this character?
Well, Herod is, believe it or not, we have more primary sources, source material on Herod the Great than anybody who ever lived prior to 1500 A.D. Isn't that hard to believe? Because Josephus, in his great work, The Jewish War and the Jewish Antiquities, his great works, gives us a court history on Herod in two whole books. And so we see in Josephus's writings the kind of person Herod was. He matches up exactly as Matthew chapter 2 styles him, as a crotchety, paranoid, a hypocrite who's murderous in his intent and who's afflicted with a medical encyclopedia full of diseases. And so the older Herod is really a very, very unattractive figure. Not so the younger Herod, not so the middle-aged Herod, but he overdid it in many ways. He married 10 wives concurrently. and they all produced princes, and so there was a tremendous fuming inside the Herodian household, turned into a can of worms. You have all the princes striving to be number one, and there can only be one number one. And so finally Herod executed three of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He killed his favorite wife, Mariamne, the beautiful Maccabean princess, killed his mother-in-law, invited the high priest down to Jericho for a swim. They played a very rough game of water polo. They drowned him. Several cousins, several uncles were executed. You know, real family man Herod was.
So Matthew is not drawing a villain's mustache on this character of Herod when he talks about him in connection with the visit of the Magi and then later the slaughter of the innocents.
No, he already had that mustache for sure.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer. He will be speaking this Saturday, January the 8th, at the Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church on the subject of St. Paul and the spread of Christianity. If you have not had opportunity to hear Dr. Meyer speak in person, you do not want to miss this opportunity. I will tell you a little bit more about that as our conversation continues. If you have a question or a comment on the Magi or the star and the story that Matthew tells, give us a call in the next 15 minutes, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Okay, the wise men very quickly passed from the scene. They bring their gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Is there any significance there beyond? I mean, I know what legend says about gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but why does Matthew see fit to mention these three things?
Well, he wouldn't have had to mention those details, but I'm glad he did. Certainly the gold is going to be very, very useful to the Holy Family on the flight to Egypt, for goodness sake. Travel is expensive. Staying away from home is expensive. And so they're going to have to, this is their American Express traveler's check, so to speak. So the gold is kind of obvious. The frankincense and myrrh could also be converted to monetary gold very easily. This is a very expensive incense in the case of the frankincense. And the myrrh is a palliative ointment. It's really interesting that right at the beginning of Jesus' life, we have the mention of myrrh. And then right at the end of his life, before his resurrection, he's buried with aloes and myrrh, you recall. It's quite interesting that this particular medicinal palliative salve shows up right at the beginning and also at the end of his ministry.
A little literary foreshadowing.
Yes, indeed.
Dave is calling from St. Charles. Dave, welcome to Issues, Etc. And we'll return to Dave if he returns to us there on the line. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kathy is calling from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the reason the Magi are in Matthew is because Matthew, is it, you know, more written to the Jewish population of that time and to show the Jewish people that God is sending his son, not just for the Jewish people, but also for the Gentile people.
Kathy.
Well, I think that's very appropriate, Kathy, indeed. In fact, sometimes Epiphany, January 6th, the celebration of the Magi visit, has been called the Christmas of the Gentiles for that reason. Clearly, we have a different racial stock involved here when the Magi arrive. And this is very, very significant. And, you know, above all that Matthew should mention, this is quite interesting because his whole gospel is geared toward his own beloved Jewish people to show that Jesus is the Messiah predicted in the Old Testament. But the very fact that he then mentions this particular episode in which non-Jews were involved is very, very important.
Okay, let's talk about the story that cannot be left out here, and that is the story of the slaughter of the innocents of Bethlehem, because it's connected with the visit of the Magi. The Magi are, it says in my reading of the scripture here, being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way, but Herod is not finished with the Christ child. How did it happen?
Well, of course, the infant massacre is the only negative note in the entire nativity account, and some, of course, critical scholars will say it never happened. Once again, it's Matthew exaggerating. Matthew's always interested in earthquakes, is interested in the star, and the infant massacre and so forth. And the argument is this, that surely a massacre like this would have come to Josephus's notice. Remember, he's our first century Jewish historian, who's so terribly important in giving us biblical type of data that borders on the gospel records. And it's true, Matt, that Josephus does not mention the infant massacre, but I think there's a couple reasons for that. Either Josephus never heard about it, or he may have heard about it and not used it. And the reason I say that is this. I'm not trying to defend Herod, but it was not a massacre, you know, on a tidal wave scale by any means. Probably only a dozen or probably less boy babies would have been involved. Little Bethlehem was a village of only about 1,000, 1,500 inhabitants in those days. And did an actuarial study on that number, you'd have only about two dozen babies, 2 years old and under, half of them the wrong sex. So with the infant mortality so very high in the ancient world anyway, frankly, something like this would probably not be deemed important enough to mention. But even if he had heard about it, Josephus has something far worse to report about Herod in his last weeks. He's now down in his winter palace in Jericho, and he's wasting away, he's ready to die, and so he calls his dear sister over. He says, Salome, I want you to arrest all the Jewish leaders in the land. And she does, and they incarcerate them in the hippodrome just below the palace. And she says, well, what do I do now? And Herod said, I know that upon my death, my people are going to be cheering. And, of course, nobody, you know, likes to have people dance in your grave. So Herod's going to give him something to cry about. He says, what I want you to do is the moment I die, I want you to execute all these hundreds of people. So there will be hundreds or thousands of households crying at the same time I die. See, now this is a more horrible thing to report about Herod in his last weeks, and so I think that's the reason Josephus chose that one.
And how we talk about the flight to Egypt, just in terms of the chronology, we have, you mentioned at the outset of our conversation, we have the baby Jesus, still a baby, perhaps as little as 41 days old, but somewhere in that neighborhood, 41 plus days. And you said probably not 2 years. Herod executes the children of Bethlehem. How long until Herod's dead and the events that follow in verse 19, the return through Jerusalem and then on to Nazareth for the Holy Family?
Okay, basically, Jesus is born sometime between July and December of 5 B.C. That's a whole different discussion, of course. Please don't blame him for bad timing. Herod dies April 1st of 4 B.C. So if we have, you know, traditionally the end of the year time when Jesus was born, which is possible, you'd have the flight to Egypt 41 days after that, or 50 days or so, and then it'd be a short sojourn there, and Herod dies, you know, a month or two later, and after that they would return.
So, I mean, I'm trying to square this with all my, you know, I'm seeing the Sunday school illustrated pictures in my mind of the Massacre of the Innocents, where it was, you know, in my little kid's mind, it was hundreds of children that were being massacred.
Yeah, wrong.
And
yeah,
then it was,
right.
They went down and spent years. Jesus was an adolescent practically by the time they came back from Egypt.
No.
All very inaccurate.
No, not that, not accurate. And first of all, as I say, it would be very few babies killed. Again, this is not to justify Herod. You know, he was a good guy, only killed 10 babies. No, not at all. But it is to say that this is not going to register very broadly.
And they returned to their home, to Nazareth. Just as briefly as we can, it says, he shall be called a Nazarene. Was that necessarily, Jesus gets called a Nazarene several times. Was that necessarily a compliment?
Well, not necessarily, because Nazareth did not have a big reputation. I recall one of the disciples saying, what good can come out of Nazareth? You know, it was a little podunk in those days. In fact, some scholars have tried to deny there ever was a Nazareth in Jesus' day, but that's now been disproven by an archaeological excavation near Caesarea, in which they have the names of the synagogues in Galilee, and Nazareth is one of them.
Dr. Paul Meyer will be speaking this Saturday, January the 8th, at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church here in St. Louis. Dr. Meyer, you're going to be speaking on St. Paul and the spread of Christianity. Just whet our listeners' appetites for some of the things that you'll deal with on Saturday's discussion at Chapel of the Cross.
Well, basically, what I love to do is to bring in additional evidence that complements a biblical record. I like to use history, archaeology, geographical inputs, and give a more complete story. And I have three different seminars in which I do that. Jesus, the one on Jesus, one on St. Paul, which is the one this coming Saturday, in which we go through and chart the life of this greatest apostle in the background and what else we know from the surrounding classical culture of the time and why Paul acts this way in this particular challenge and so on. So it's a lot of fun.
Now, by the way, folks, if you want to attend this this event with Dr. Paul Meyer, our guest, as he talks about St. Paul and the spread of Christianity at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in St. Louis, the address, 11645, that's 11645 Benham Road. It's from 9:30 a.m. until 3:15, an entire well-worth-your-time day. The doors are open at 9 for coffee and donuts. Tickets are $15. If you're a student, that's $8, and you got to be 18 and younger there. And also, that ticket price includes lunch, and you can reserve tickets by calling Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church at 741-3737. That's area code 314-741-3737, 9:30 a.m. to 3:15 p.m. with Dr. Paul Meyer. He'll be speaking there, and you do not want to miss this, folks. He'll be speaking there at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church at 11645 Benham Road in St. Louis on St. Paul and the spread of Christianity. The number again for the church, area code 314-741-3737. Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd, and a blessed new year to you.
And to you as well. Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He has authored several books, including his latest, a novel titled More Than a Skeleton. And as I mentioned before, this coming Saturday, January the 8th, he's going to be speaking at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church on the subject of St. Paul and the spread of Christianity. Well, God is about tying up loose strings. And of course, really nothing is beneath him when he wants to keep promises, especially regarding his son Jesus Christ and the salvation that Jesus came to bring. Even in the infancy of his son Jesus Christ, he is fulfilling promises. He's fulfilling promises about where the Christ child will be born and who will come to see him. The Old Testament is full of this, that when the Christ appears, there he will draw the whole world in. And here is a foretaste of that. These wise men from the East, however they were informed of the birth, by a miraculous star or a natural occurrence in the skies, what they knew or didn't know really is irrelevant. God is fulfilling a promise. He is drawing to the Christ child, to the King of Kings, these wise men from the East. And God is about fulfilling promises. Already there are the foreshadowings of Christ's burial. One of the gifts they give him is myrrh used in his burial, Matthew will later tell us. There's the shedding of blood. Jesus will say later, I did not come to bring peace but a sword. And God is always about fulfilling promises, ultimately fulfilled in that Christ child at the cross and raised from the dead for us. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.